For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome. I'm very happy to have with us here this evening Paul Kopp from the University of Chicago and old friend. And Paul is here to speak with us about this chant we've just done, the Enmejuku Kanongyo, the short sutra for preserving life of the Bodhisattva of Compassion. So thank you, Paul, for being here and for speaking with us.
Well, thank you for having me, and thanks everybody for coming. It's a pleasure to be here. This is a text I like very much, I love very much. One that I've been thinking about and chanting, of course, for quite a long time now. And so it's really great, really grateful for the chance to be able to think through what it's about with you all here together tonight. I thought I would just kind of go through it line by line, in part, give some of the doctrinal, historical, I can't say the historical background of the text itself, because I actually know very little about it, but about the ideas that are expressed in it, and about the ideas that are expressed in it, and about how it may connect with other texts that you will be familiar with, I think, especially the Heart Sutra, I thought I would, since I think that's a text that we are all quite familiar with, and that we chant in English, of course, so we probably have more of a sense of what's going on there than we do in this one. I've forgotten actually what the official translation was, and so I gave, this is a very literal. Does everyone have the handout? We do. Okay. A very literal word-by-word translation of the title there. Life extending or... life extending. 10-phrase, 10-sentence, 10-statement canon scripture, right? Or scripture of canon, as I put it there. Now it begins as we just chanted, as we know, with the phrase kanzeon. Now kanzeon is kanon, right? Another there are many names for this one. In a sense, I guess we should say one being, right? Who is also called, for example, in the Heart Sutra, Avalokiteshvara, right? In Chinese, Guanyin, Guanshiyin. Guanzizai, Kanjizai, right? I mean, these are all different ways of rendering the name of the being, of the figure, especially in Mahayana Buddhism, famous in Zen in our case, that I think most of us think of as the Bodhisattva of Compassion, right? We hear this most often about Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of Compassion. However, I think, for those of us who practice in Zendos, right, and who chant the Heart Sutra and the Enmejuku Kanongyo, also a figure of insight, right, a bodhisattva of wisdom. Now, insight or wisdom and compassion are, you know, they're separated as different categories of practice, right? But in one of the most pervasive metaphors for the nature of Buddhist practice, we have is this idea that a bird needs two wings, right? A bird needs two wings to fly, not just one. One wing, insight, wisdom, discernment, and the other wing, compassion. So the Bodhisattva doesn't fly without both wings, right? And neither does, and so Kanzeon does not. So the Bodhisattva of compassion, in the Heart Sutra and in this text, perhaps especially the Bodhisattva of insight, right? Insight is mostly what's emphasized here, at least I would like to say. And let me also say that the reading I offer of this text is, you know, fairly idiosyncratic one, perhaps. It's my own reading of the text. There are others out there. And you will read slightly different takes on what some of this means there. So, Kanzeon, it begins with an invocation, as I would like to put it, or at least a calling out to Kanzeon, Bodhisattva of insight and compassion. And then it continues in its this sort of invocatory mode, right? Namu Butsu. Butsu is the Buddha, of course, simply means Buddha. Namu is a term of, again, of devotion, of invocation. Simply a transliteration via Chinese of this Indic Sanskrit word namo, which does it have a meaning specifically? Joy, I have to turn to you on this. But it's a term of devotion, right? Veneration too, usually translated as. We have Joy Brennan here, our Sanskrit expert, for those of you listening at home. So a term of veneration, honor to, devotion to, etc., to the Buddha. Kanzeon, honor to the Buddha, right? This is how it begins. And many, many, I call them ritual texts. People might not like the term ritual, but texts that are chanted in places like this, in situations like this, begin with invocations, right? You invoke first the Buddha, a particular bodhisattva, or here both, right? The Heart Sutra begins Avalokiteshvara, and then what Avalokiteshvara was doing. So, not exactly an invocation, but along those lines, perhaps. Now it sort of changes modes, and we start to get some of the text's claims about reality, right? Claims about the way things are, claims about the nature of practice, which, and as I will try to convince you, the text is really, as I read it anyway, a text about the nature of practice, right? It begins with this invocation and with a set of affirmations about the nature of practice, about the conditions for practice, the conditions for awakening. I kind of think that the text is in three parts, an invocation and an affirmation, and then the crux of it, this one line, which we'll get to a little later, again, a very much an affirmation and a statement about the way things are. And then an explication in the sense of sort of how you do that. How do you realize this very, in some ways, difficult, I think, statement about the way things are. That's part three, how it ends. So, like many Zen texts, especially like many pre-modern Zen texts or pre-modern East Asian Buddhist texts in general, it's about the way things are, right? It's about what reality is. It's about, especially, the nature of the relationship between the mind, the person, and reality, right? Not ontology, you know, the statements about the nature of being for its own sake, of course, but statements about the way things are that can support our practice, right? So that we can get things right and eventually really get things right, I guess, which is in some sense why we're all here. Think about the beginning of what's the Eightfold Path, right? What's the first fold in the Eightfold Path, right? What's the first item on the list, right? Right view, right or correct view. So even there, once again, sort of seeing things right, getting things correct, according to the tradition, is a basic move, a basic necessity for doing practice. At least as I understand these texts to be telling us. But for all that, right, we chant it in Japanese. Right, and it's a text, I believe, I have no firm evidence of this, that it was written in written in Japan in what's called Sino-Japanese, right? That is, I've given you the Chinese characters there, but I feel strongly, I have no real evidence for this, that it was not written in China, not written to be pronounced in Chinese. I say this only because if you sort of chant it in Chinese, I don't think it works. The rhythm is not there in the same way that it is in Japanese. In Japanese, in Sino-Japanese, as we say, it's such a powerful text. It's such a natural text to chant, I think. You really can get into it. Years ago, when I was first starting practice, I was living at a Zen center, Zen monastery, and especially during the longer sessions, the longer retreats, we would chant this many, many times in a row. And you would start out with this sort of stately beat, this stately measure, right? And then as it goes on, the wooden fish would be, you know, the timekeeping drum would be beat much progressively faster, right? And we would chant it louder and louder and faster and faster. And so it became, at least in my own feeling, this kind of ecstatic text, right? Very different from the rest of my own feeling, my own experience of what we were doing in the Zendo during Sesshin, which can feel sometimes a bit austere and difficult and contained, right? And then you have this opportunity to really kind of let loose in a way, but let loose in a way, and again, at least for me, that's into this text that very much will contain even the most passionate letting go, right? It can really hold you. And I don't know if anyone's read the works of this, for a long time now, Zen teacher himself, Peter Matheson, who, I believe it's in his book, The Snow Leopard, but I think this particular story is also recopied or taken, it reappears again in his the selections from his Zen journals published sometime after that, Nine-Headed Dragon River, something like that?
Yes.
He tells a story, I'm not going to retell it here, I don't want to ruin it for you, involving this text where he was chanting it in a Zendo under extremely difficult personal in an extremely difficult personal situation, and the text is this allows this kind of vision, really, experience for him that I found extremely powerful, especially when I was a wee lad first beginning the practice and looking for inspiration. Not that I'm not looking for it now. So it's a story that I recommend to you. So we chanted here again, you know, in Japanese. I think few of us understand Japanese, speak Japanese. And that's fine, that's good. It certainly has its place and it has tremendous power in that form. But it does have meaning. And I've pulled back from telling you what that meaning was, and I'll get back into it in a minute. But I think in Japan, when people chant it, they would hear it also as language, right? Also as meaning, right? Also as a set of statements about things, about practice, about the way things are. And so that's why I'm giving this talk here tonight, in the hope that knowing a little bit about what's going on in the text, I give you both a literal translation, and then, you know, I will give you my own sort of sense of what that's all about. So back into the text then. Kanzeon Namo Butsu, right? And now we have two statements, two sentences, two phrases that are very similar to each other, just only one word different. Yo Butsu U In, and then Yo Butsu U En. In and En. Here's the translation. With the Buddha, there are the causes, In. With the Buddha, there are the conditions, En. The causes and conditions, right? The causes and conditions of what, you might ask. Well, that's a good question, isn't it? It doesn't say. I think that it must be the cause and conditions of awakening. And thus, the causes and conditions of practice. Because as we know, as students of Dogen, practice and awakening are, well, they're the same thing somehow. And I think that this text very much agrees with that position. Continuing on, Bukpo So En, same En, conditions. Bukpo So, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, right? So we have, with the Buddha there are the causes, with the Buddha there are the conditions, and that with, that yo, can probably be taken much stronger than I'm explaining it here, you know, but I'll just leave you to think about what being with the Buddha, or what with the Buddha might mean. The conditions of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, that is, of course, so here, this is why I think it's the conditions of practice, the conditions of awakening. The three jewels of our practice, right? The three jewels of Buddhism. The teacher, the Buddha, the teachings, the Dharma, and the community of practitioners, the Sangha. With the Buddha, there are perhaps these conditions. There are perhaps these causes and conditions. So this is what I understand, at least in my reading, to be sort of part one of the text. It sort of sets things up as these things go. Kanze on namu butsu yo butsu in yo butsu en butpo so en. Right? This is what these are the conditions of practice. This is what we have in practice. We have each other. We have the teachings. We have the teacher. We have the Buddha. We have Kanzeon. And the text is going to loop back on Kanzeon at the end. And we're going to find out that, well, Kanzeon seems to be this person sitting on our cushion. Now, the next line, line 6, as I have it numbered here, is, for me, the crux of the text, and I'm really going to spend most of my time here talking about it. Jo Rakuga Jo, right? Literally, permanence, joy, self, and purity. Now, I imagine some of you will recognize this in a sort of a funhouse mirror way as a sort of an upside-down version of what are usually called the three marks of existence, right? One of the, among the very oldest, as far as we can tell, of all Buddhist teachings, right? What is reality like? What characteristics characterize reality? Impermanence, right? Suffering, and no self. And then in some later versions also, impurity. So, what could it possibly mean? You know, how could this text, why is this text then telling us that things are exactly the opposite of that, right? This needs some explaining, I think. It actually is a very common flip, the sort of flip side, as I put it here, of the three marks, the traditional three marks, or four marks of reality, found in a particular late Mahayana tradition of thought and practice called the Tathagata Garbha, right? What's that? Well, translated the womb of the Buddha or the embryo of the Buddha. I'm not really going to spend a lot of time on that. Also, a tradition of Buddhist thought usually put under the banner or the tagline of Buddha nature, right? Originally, the Tathagata Garbha thought is simple. It's a very simple idea that we all have within us, metaphorically, the capacity for Buddhahood. Or not metaphorically, we all have within us the capacity for Buddhahood, right? It's a sort of a simple statement of optimism, right? We can do it, you know? You don't have to be some special being to become a Buddha. We can do it, right? We all have the womb or the embryo, same word, of the Buddha within us. And the Tathagata Garbha Sutra, scripture, is a series of metaphors illustrating this. One of them is a golden Buddha statue hidden in the mud, right? All we see is mud, you know. Common experience thinking about myself. But actually, underneath there, if we could only see it, if we could dig down, is a golden Buddha statue. That's what we actually are, right? This is early Tathagata Garbha thinking. Now this, as time goes by, and based on logics of Buddhist thought that were always there, they come to say instead, well, it's not just that we can become the Buddha, it's that, well, in fact, we already are the Buddha, just as we are, right? And this goes even farther, perhaps especially in Japan, but not only there, where you have statements like, the world, this, right, is the Buddha, the body of the Buddha, right? Very common ideas, I think. Some of you will have heard or read, or both, different versions of this, right? So rather than try to explain this and give a history lesson about the Tathagatagarbha, I thought I would talk about it in terms of the Heart Sutra, which is a text that, you know, we all know, at least to some extent, right? And especially what I imagine are the most famous lines of the Heart Sutra, which goes something like, form is empty, emptiness is form. Or often, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. I prefer to think of it as form is empty, emptiness, the condition of emptiness, well, that's form. So how does that work? Let's take the first one, right? Form is empty. Things are not what they seem, right? Things are not as we experience them. Our normal experience, understanding of form, and not just form, but all the other constituents of human experience, they are empty, right? In the sense, what does that mean? We're wrong about them, right? Our understanding about them is mistaken, right? We think of them as being there in ways that they actually aren't, if we could only see things clearly, right? On one, there are different ways of explaining this, different ways of understanding it, it has different manifestations. One is that what we, our experience of forms, of phenomena, right, is the result, in a sense, of projections. Projections of what? Projections of the structure of consciousness, projections of our personal histories, projections of desire and aversion, projections of culture, all that stuff, right? What we're seeing is actually that stuff, not what's actually there, right? And so all that stuff is empty in a particular sense, right? There are other ways that emptiness is explained. You know, things don't have essences. Things don't have abiding essences. They have histories, right? They have relationships. They come together through relationships, etc. You will all be, I think, familiar with these ideas. And so this kind of connects with a mode of practice, right, that we can call perhaps the nirvana mode, right, the nirvanic mode, that somehow if we could nirvanize, right, extinguish, nirvana just means extinguish in a sense, all the stuff that gets in the way of our seeing things wrongly, right, if we could not project, if we could extinguish those projections, if we could extinguish the passions, the klesha, right, the delusions, then we would see things clearly, right? And if the Heart Sutra only said, you know, form is emptiness, gate gate paragate parasangate bodhisattva, you know, then I think that pretty clearly that's the picture that it would be giving, right? Let's just get rid of the delusions, you know, and then exist in this, under the conditions of nirvana, whatever that is, whatever that might be like, then we'd be good, right? But it doesn't. It doesn't stop right there. It immediately goes, spins around in a sense, right? Comes back on itself. Emptiness is form, right? And here's the Jōraku Gajō part. I'm working toward that, and here's that part. At least this is what I'm going to try to convince you of. But it's not the case, right, that we should just somehow get to some state of nirvana and bliss and, you know, some mystic, if we could only, like, get rid of the cobwebs and plunge through the cloud of unknowing, you know, and get to some state of pure samadhi or something and just live there, everything would be good, right? No, this is not what the Heart Sutra is saying, as I understand it. It's saying there is no such place, right? There is no such other world for Heart Sutra readers, right? It's just this. That world, right, is this. It's just form. It's just phenomena. It's just delusion, right? It's just the world as we experience it, right? there's all these different fun statements floating out there in the Buddhist world and otherwise. Right? One of them I like works here. Things are not as they seem, right? Form is empty. Nor are they otherwise. I always like that. I don't know where this comes from, but it's pretty wonderful, right? Mm-hmm. Emptiness is form, right? There is no pure world of otherworldly mystic union that we should want to, importantly, even if we could, get to it. This is it, right? This world of experience, of regular old human delusion, I'm sorry, it's at least designed, you know, according to these teachings, this is the Dharma Dhatu, right? The realm of reality. This is the world of the Buddhas, right? This is the body of the Buddha. So you have, for example, a lot, many, 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 many statements in Zen literature, right? What is the way, right? And the Tao, right? And it's important, I think, in this case, especially to understand the Tao, the way, in these old Chinese texts, and as I'm thinking at the moment, the Tao is the most wonderful, most, I don't like this word sacred, but let me use it anyway, most sacred thing, the most holy thing. You know, this is the highest value in Chinese religious thought, right? Not just in Buddhism, all of it. What is the way? What is the Tao? Ordinary mind, right? Famous line in Zen Chan literature, Zen literature. Ordinary mind. Not some magical, golden, emitting, shiny, sparkly mind of the Buddha. No. Ordinary mind, right? Of course, it can get even more... there's, on the one hand, there's this sort of ordinary mind style of teaching. On the other hand, there's the pictures that we get in the Avatamsaka Sutra, right, in the Huayan Jing, where they, you know, you read this and what is the world actually like? It's this sort of amazing world of shining light. And then this is understood often in this tagline that's associated with the, it comes, I believe, from a commentary. Commentaries to the Avatamsaka Sutra that says, each thing is everything, right? And everything is each thing, right? One is all is one. So it's ordinary mind, right? But it's understood clearly, right? It's understood as the way a Buddha would understand it. And so here I'm being extremely presumptuous trying to tell you what that might be. But bang, back to, I like to stay, I think, even though we have this line that I'm trying to explicate, eternality, permanence, right, joy, self, purity, sounds wonderful, right? And it sounds like not just, you know, cushion on a hardwood floor, my left foot falling asleep as it's doing at this moment, but, you know, something more magical than that. But it's the same kind of, it's expressed differently, right? It's this stuff we find expressed in lines like the passions themselves are awakening, right? So we have in the nirvanic world, the nirvanic way of seeing things, get rid of the passions. The passions get in the way of seeing things clearly. In this later Mahayana Chan Zen world, the passions are awakening, right? Understood correctly, at least. Nirvana and samsara are the same place, etc. Again, this goes even further. In Chan literature, right, when people ask, "What is the Buddha?" What is the Buddha? It's a measure of hemp, right? It's a pile of cloth. The Buddha's a pile of cloth, right? And the most dramatic of all, you know, what is the Buddha? Presumably pointing to a specimen, a dried piece of shit, right? That is the Buddha, right? It's hard to get any more sort of earthy and away from, you know, the world of trying to get, well, the world, a world somehow apart from our normal, difficult, earthly world than that, right? But this is one of the most, in my mind anyway, lovely and important statements in the tradition. But let's be more poetic about it, right? Dogen quotes a poem attributed to Sudongpo. I've never been able to find this in a Sudongpo collection, but anyway, Dogen says it was Sudongpo. The sounds of the valley are the Buddha's long, broad tongue. The colors are of the mountain are his unconditioned body. Right. Jo-raku-ga-jo, right? That's what that line is about, as I understand it. So we begin, we have the conditions of practice. We have the Buddha. And then we have Jo-raku-ga-jo, this statement about the actual nature of things, right? In this very optimistic, in this very affirming, you could hardly get more affirming view of things. Now, as Dogen, on my reading and Dogen's teachings, you have to understand that it's very hard to see this correctly, right? And it's very easy to misunderstand it and to somehow go around worshipping, you know, mountains and rocks and trees as somehow being mistaken. You know, that's a mistaken view. Of somehow being, the substrate of reality that if we can only get to. Because it's not just that the world is reality, but that reality is empty too, right? Form is empty, emptiness is form. You have to have them both, right? I'll leave the more refined teachings of how to understand all this to Taigen, of course. So how do you do it anyway? Right? I haven't finished our text, and the text does give some explanation of how you do all this, right? What is the nature of practice that could lead you, that could help you to understand things as Jo-raku-ga-jo, right? Well, Cho-nen-kan-ze-yon, Bo-nen-kan-ze-yon. Again, we have another couplet, right, where only one word is changed. Here, the first word. Cho in the morning, Bo in the evening, right? In the morning, Nen Kanzeyan, right? In the morning, contemplate, call out to, be mindful of, invoke Kanzeyan. In the evening, invoke, contemplate, etc. Kanzeyan. Nen is an important word with different meanings in Buddhism, especially in East Asian Buddhism. Sino-Japanese word, after all. It's the translation, among other things, of the word sati, right, or smriti, right, that gets translated into English as mindfulness. Mm-hmm. So it means to keep things in mind, right, to be aware of, to bring your awareness to. But it has a wider range of objects than, at least in my experience, people usually talk about when they talk about mindfulness these days, right? It's not just mindfulness of the breath, mindfulness of the contents of experience. It's also mindfulness of the Buddha, right? Mindfulness of the good qualities of the Buddha, right? And in this way, it sort of connects with, as I understand it anyway, practices of devotion, right? Practices of invocation. So, to nembutsu, right, is to call out the Buddha's name. So, in Japanese, if you go to Japan, you will often hear Buddhists say, Namu Amida Butsu, right? Namu, we've already had this word. Amida Butsu, the veneration to the Buddha, Amitabha, right? It can mean simply that. And here, it probably, you know, this is a chanting text, and so this is what we're doing, essentially, is a kind of Nembutsu, right? A kind of calling out to, in this case, not the Buddha, but to Kanzeyon, right? So here is the practice, and this, that it's recommending here, or that it's embedded within. But how do you understand that, right? And here's the key, and the last two lines are another, not difficult exactly, but profound statement about practice. Nen nen ju shin ki, nen nen fu ri shin, right? Nen nen, as I understand it here, at each nenning, right, and each invocation, each kanzeyon, 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 each time, right, kanzeyon, implied subject, arises or is there together with the mind, right? In each invocation, kanzeyon is not separate from the mind, furishin. It's together with the mind, he, she is together with the mind. He, she, kanzeyon is not separate from the mind, right? The mind is kanzeyon, right? But only perhaps when you're practicing. So here's why I think the text is implying very subtly that if we don't nen kanzeyon, right? If we don't practice, then maybe Kantayana is not there, right? Maybe we are not doing practice and awakening, right? There's I think I wrote it down there. I don't remember now. One of my favorite lines, again, you find in Zen texts, right? If you write demon on the page, right, then there is a demon, right? If you write Buddha on the page, then there is a Buddha, right? It's the practicing, right? It's the mind. It's the mind as actualized in practice that brings Kanzeyon, you know, into the room, right? That brings Kanzeyon onto the cushion. So when we begin this text, Kanzeyon, right? You know, who is Kanzeyon, right? Where is Kanzeyon? Thank you. Happy to have questions or attacks.
I can't imagine attacks, but
well, you know, I teach up there.
I'll add some. I'll add a couple things.
Yeah, please.
Just I totally love everything you said. That this is a text that is about invoking practice. It's a text that it's not about something else. It's a text that does something. A text in which we call on Kanzeyon and we express Kanzeyon. It's a very vigorous, active, a vivid text. I just your reading of Yobutsu in Yobutsu and Bupo Soen, I recall when I first studied the meaning of this that to add to what your interpretation was, that in some sense, Yobutsu and Yobutsu, and we are, to add a first person, or a first person plural, we have causes and conditions connecting us to Buddha. We have causes, we have conditions connecting us to Buddha Dharma Sangha. Just as a way, again, of invoking that connection. So that part of it is something that I've always felt, and I don't know where I saw that, what that. But that's some part of it that I've always felt also.
Yeah,
I don't know if you have any comment on that.
Well, that makes a lot of sense too. I mean, that's in Chinese, in Taiwan years ago when I was spending quite a bit of time at a Buddhist temple there, people would often say, oh, you know, Ni Gan Fo Yo Yuan, right? You and the Buddha have N, right?
Right.
Meaning you're here, so you have this karmic connection with the Buddha, right? So that's not exactly right.
So it's a way of invoking our own connection with Buddha and Bupo So, Buddha Dharma Sangha.
Yeah, yeah. We have that connection, yeah.
Can I add something that I thought of when you were talking about 3 and 4, the connection and the condition?
Yeah.
It jumped out at me. This is the first time it ever jumped out at me. In a lot of the, like, I think in this language, the nirvanized philosophies, like that's the goal. They say there's no cause or condition for awakening. So there's that kind of gap between. And so it just jumped out at me that this is inverting also that. And it's saying, well, there is the cause and condition. Mm-hmm. Like Taigen was just saying. Anyway,
can I ask you a question?
Can Paul or Taigen, how do you then see, I mean, so Paul, you emphasized at the beginning that you want to lean heavy on the Kanzeyon as wisdom and insight.
Well,
can you then get compassion back? Like, how would you then?
Yeah, let's get some compassion back in the room. How do we do that? Bring it back. You want me to spend some compassion on this? Oh. Please.
So I learned this chant in English first.
Oh, really? Great.
So I'm going to tell you the way we used to say it.
I've never heard it
so. I wrote it down even, I know it totally, if I started to do it, I would forget it. Kanzeyon, praise to Buddha, all awake to Buddha, all are one with Buddha, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, eternal, joyous, selfless, pure. Through the day comes aeon, through the night comes aeon, this moment arises from mind, this moment itself is mine. So it's just sort of an interesting, very interesting.
Well, the selfless is interesting. I mean, I think there's, because we know what the Buddha taught, right?
That's
and that's
right.
That there's no self. And so it's very, it's one struggles with this idea that there could be, what do you mean self? But not self in that sense. I mean, I like to think of it in, again, my reading of one of them, it's Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and Suzuki Roshi talks about big mind. Mm-hmm. That's how I like to understand that here, however, whether or not that's correct or not, but it's helpful for me. What is compassion? If we are one, right? If we are, if it all rises together, if we have these connections together, then that is, compassion is sort of active insight, right? The thought of emptiness gives rise to compassion, as they say in Majjhima, as the Buddhists say. Seeing that we are, that all things are inter-are, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, right? Seeing that, we are here together in delusion, that's also somehow the Dharma Dhatu, there is naturally a kind of compassionate being together. So I like to think there might be. Is that a hand? Mm-hmm. I thought you were moving your hand. I thought you were asking a question.
No, I guess I do have a question. What's delusion?
Is that a trick question?
Yeah.
It is. Oh, good. So can I fall into? Should I fall into the trap? How shall I spring the trap then? How shall I fall into? Well, why do you? What do you mean? What's delusion? Why do you ask?
Well,
I use this word, and so what do I? What did I mean by delusion?
Yeah.
Well, specifically. I think I used the term trying to understand this line, form is empty, right? Our normal everyday experience of things is somehow wrong, right? Leading it, and wrong, and who cares if it's wrong, right? But it's wrong specifically, importantly, because it causes suffering, right? It causes us to get stuck, to mess things up for ourselves and others. Right, and so delusion, perhaps one way of thinking about it and thinking about that line again is that it's the particular kind of mistake about reality that messes us up, right? The mistake that messes. I think I won't use that phrase anymore, mistake that messes. And it works a lot. Anyway, is that helpful? I mean, you could also say, "Oh, delusion is awakening," right? I mean, if I wanted to, play that game, but I don't feel qualified to. So let me just, give a sort of professorial classroom answer. Strictly speaking, under the conditions of that line, it's this mistake that causes suffering.
That's good.
Please.
I have actually two questions. I have to check. So I actually didn't quite understand the part that you talked about most.
Yeah.
What you were saying about those four words.
Yeah. Okay. So traditionally, you have the three marks of existence, right? The world is impermanent. The world is characterized by suffering, often, and the world doesn't have essences, right? Doesn't have self.
Right.
And this is because we don't understand that and we think it does have those things, we get messed up, right? And so one way of thinking of it as that view of the world is the view of the world under the conditions of delusion, if I could use this word, of mistaking things, right? Of normal human consciousness. We think that, I exist as I am right now, eternally, that's a mistake. Because actually impermanence, suffering, and no non-essence, no abiding essence, that works for that understanding of reality, right? The sort of normal human understanding of reality in which we get confused about things. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Actually, I guess my understanding is, you know, it's sort of like the delusion is that things are permanent and then we keep suffering because they're impermanent.
Okay, yeah. So normally, with the way we, as regular folk, see the world, it's exactly like that, right? Mm-hmm. And it's better to understand that the world is impermanent, that there's suffering, and that it doesn't have abiding essences. That's the sort of human perspective, we could say. Now, the perspective of a Buddha, right? The perspective of emptiness, the perspective of perfect insight, in a way, is that the another way of talking about emptiness, right, is that things arise according to conditions, that things arise in relationships, right? And the sort of pure relationality of the world, right, is, in a sense, permanent, right? That's the world, right? And it pops up in different ways, right? I mean, there's the famous text called the Awakening of Faith in the Mahayana, which uses this language of water and waves, right? And if you look at it from the perspective of waves, waves are impermanent, right? And maybe if waves are stuck on their permanence, they suffer, right? And waves don't have abiding essences because they're always changing, you know, millisecond by millisecond. And if you get attached to a particular wave, you're going to have problems, right? But if you look at it simply as water, right? Ocean, and remember this is a metaphor, right?
Sure.
Ocean is permanent, right? Ocean is, in a sense, perhaps joyful, right? Ocean as a kind of self, right? Big self, right? Mm-hmm. Not the normal kind of self. Mm-hmm. And I didn't talk so much about purity, but it gets confusing. I like to leave that off. Does that make sense? I mean, this sort of water
sort of
wave
thing. Embracing... is this part of what you're saying, too, that it's almost like as... when you follow Buddhist teachings, then you're like, oh, right, nothing's permanent. Oh, yeah, I know all this. Like, as if that's the truth. And this is sort of subverting that. It's like, yeah, actually the opposite. It's just like form is emptiness, emptiness. So in some ways it's subverting it and saying, it's turning it on its head, as you said, I think.
I like to think of it as, you know, the duck rabbit. The rabbit duck, you know, you've seen these pictures where you look at it, it's a drawing of a rabbit,
right.
And you look at it, and all you see is rabbit, and then suddenly you look at it differently, all you see is duck.
Right, both things are true.
Exactly, right? Yeah. So it's a kind of a duck rabbit in a way.
Okay.
I mean, that's a way of conceptualizing it, whether or not it's going to help you ultimately. Yeah.
Along those same lines, I guess I have a question. The whole form is emptiness is form thing. You know, I can start to get my mind wrapped around that and, you know, maybe, okay, there's this empty quality to form. And that even when we've got, so form is emptiness, and then emptiness or whatever concept I have of it has some formness to it. But didn't we also say form is also form and emptiness is also emptiness? And it seems like this really is in line with sort of that, is that in some ways, that's harder for me to understand. Is it in some ways, as Buddhists, we think of, okay, form is emptiness, emptiness is form, but then when you actually have to get down to, well, but you know what, form is also form. So we want to just see the emptiness part of it, but there's the form part and the form as well. And so kind of, it seems to be inverting it to me in that way, in that it's saying, no, there really is permanence. Don't get lost in impermanence. Permanence is there too. Which is, I think, more of a challenge for folks like us who kind of spend so much time thinking about anatman, about emptiness, about no soul, to say, yeah, but there's a positive aspect to that also. Or am I going way off here?
No, I don't think so. And, I mean, on the one hand, one answer to that, one thing I'd like to say toward that is that, of course, it's important not to get stuck on either side. I mean, this is the again and again and again and again we have. I mean, my favorite one, the one I use in class all the time, is, you know, you hold up a piece of chalk and you say, what is this? If you say it's a piece of chalk, I throw it at you, right? Mm-hmm. If you say it's a piece of chalk, I throw it at you. Form is empty, right? If you say it's not a piece of chalk, I throw it at you, right? I mean, this is from Lin Ji. He's going to whack you with a stick, but, you know. I can't do that with my students in class, but maybe I can throw some chalk at them. And so if you say it's not a piece of chalk, then I throw it at you, right? Because emptiness is form. This is a piece of chalk. Hello, right? I mean, get with the program here, right? So there's that. On the other hand, I think it is fair to say that in East Asia, they tended to think that this sort of more affirmative emphasis, the Buddha is the sound of the valley and the form of the mountains and all that stuff, is more conducive to practice than, let's just get rid of our, the sort of negative and sort of nirvanic view of things. There's a philosopher named Adorno, I don't know, I'm going pretty far afield here, but I believe it's in his book Minima Moralia. He says something like, the only philosophy, it's not exactly like this, I'm paraphrasing, the only philosophy that could possibly work in the face of despair is that which takes the world under the conditions of, he doesn't say liberation, of salvation, right? But we might say liberation or awakening or something. And I think that Jo Rakugajo, that is the world under the conditions of awakening, or it's pointing toward that. And this of taking the wondrous being, to translate a Chinese phrase, of the world, rather than the sort of emptiness of things, also has its value. And again, at least on my understanding, in China, Japan, Korea, a lot of these traditions, they tend to emphasize that, right? The Buddha is this, it's not just East Asia, right? This does come from India. You have to have the same things in India. The Lotus Sutra, of course, the famous story of, Nirvana, that's just this, this just little guest house we built for you. You weren't supposed to stay there. You're supposed to keep on going, right? I mean, this shows up in different ways around the world. But.
Just, we're a little over time, but just to add, going back to how is this compassion, and following up on your affirmative slant, and following up on what you said about Nin, I think there's also an affirmative and functional aspect of that. Chonen Kanzayan, Bonen Kanzayan, Nen Nen Jishinki, Nen Nen Furishin. That Nen, as you were saying, is mindfulness, it's Nembutsu. And one other way I think of that is, you said to remind ourselves of Buddha, or to remember Buddha.
Yeah.
So to...
I didn't say that, but that's true.
Yeah, well, it's another way of saying what you said. So it's a positive way of saying, yes, Buddha, to bring Buddha to mind, to bring Kanzeon to mind, to remind ourselves of compassion and insight, as you said. So anyway, thank you very, very much for opening up this chant that we've been doing for us and some of the meaning of it, and I really appreciate your coming and sharing this
with us. Well, thank you all very much.